into criticism and investigates the humor of the subject with the help of Alfred Marx.
After attending four different plays at the Edinburgh Festival, one critic wrote, "After listening to the plays by the different national writers, I conclude that an Englishman thinks and speaks, a Scot thinks twice before he speaks, a Welshman speaks before he thinks, and an Irishman speaks." Three muggers criticised their Irish victim for putting up a hell of a fight for the small change he had in his pockets. "Why did you struggle so hard for only 26 pence? "Well," he said, "I talked to her after the £10 note I got here stuck in me sock." The judge criticised the defendant who had committed bigamy and said he'd give him the maximum penalty. The counsel for the defence said, "My lord, he's already got it. Two mothers-in-law." A woman bought her husband two ties for his birthday. Next morning he came down to breakfast wearing one of them. And she stuck straight into him.
"Oh, I see."
"Didn't like the other one, eh?" Three tortoises in a pub.
They ran out of fags.
And one said, "All right, I'll go and get them." And the other two waited in the boozy, you see. After 3 hours, one of the tortoises in the booze turned that one and said, "It's been 3 hours. What's keeping him?" The pub door opened, the third tortoise said, "Look, if you're going to start criticizing, you can go and get him yourself." Fellow went down the East End to his barber. While he was sitting in the barber's chair having his hair cut, he said to his barber, "I'm going off holiday next week to Italy." The barber said, "What do you want to go to Italy for? Smells of garlic. The old place." He says, "No, it does." "Yes, it does, yes." He says, "I'm going to Venice." He says, "What do you want to go to Venice for?" He says, "All them canals. They smell rotten, all them mosquitoes." He said, "No." He said, "I'm going to go to Rome." He says, "What do you want to go to Rome for? It's a big city like London, and it's all the same." Anyway, he went. 2 weeks later, he went back to the barber, sat in the chair having his hair cut. Barber said, "You got it?" He said, "Oh, yes, had a marvellous time. You don't know what you're talking about. It was fantastic. Italy's beautiful. Smells of flowers. Doesn't smell of garlic at all. It's beautiful. All them lovely canals. No smell. No mosquitoes. Beautiful. And then I went around. Beautiful city. All them monuments. All them ancient buildings. And while I was there, I went to St. Peter's. And what's more, I had a private audience with a Pope." The barber said, "Go on." Barber said, "What did he say to you?" I said, "He said to me, 'Where'd you get that lousy haircut?'"
Well, nobody likes being criticised. So on the whole, critics of the various arts have had a pretty bad press over the years. Since almost every artist has at some stage or other had a bad review somewhere, they tend to get vehement on the subject of critics. Here's Lord Byron.
"As soon seek roses in December, ice in June, hope constancy in wind or corn in chaff, believe a woman or an epitaph, or any other thing that's false before you trust in critics."
Archbishop C. Garbett.
"Any fool can criticize, and many of them do."
Dr. Johnson.
"Criticism is a study by which men grow important and formidable at very small expense."
Critics have always been accused of living a parasitical existence, battening off the hard work of artists. Sir Henry Wood.
"Critics are like the brushers of noblemen's clothes."
With this constant outpouring of scorn, it's important to remember that the basic principle of criticism is a worthy one, and that some individuals have raised the trade to an art by their skill and wisdom. In the political world, criticism can be one of the precursors of social change. Often the idealistic young have a vision to criticize the old-fashioned values which their parents' generation has never questioned.
"Seated one day at the tom-tom, shout from the kitchen, 'Come and get it! Roast leg of insurance salesman.'" A chorus of yums ran round the table. "Yum, yum, 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 yum." Except for Junior, who pushed away his shell, got up from his log, and said, "I don't want any part of it." "Why not?" "I don't eat people." "I won't eat people." "I don't eat people." Juju had meant us not to eat people, he wouldn't have made us of meat. Such a ridiculous idea in all my born days. To think that a son of mine should grow up to be a sissy. Me, chief assistant to the assistant chief. Why, if this was to get around, son, it could just about ruin me socially.
I won't eat people.
Have you been talking to one of your mothers again? I suppose you're one of those cranks that thinks it's cruel, is that it? You see a man sitting in a pot and you think he's suffering. Not like that at all. He's just sitting there in the nice warm water, thinking of all the pleasure and happiness he's going to give to a whole heap of people. He knows it's better than just dying of old age. Why, that man in the pot there, he enjoys it.
Eating people is wrong.
Look, son, you're young. I know how you feel. I've been young myself. When you're young, you want to change the whole world overnight, but it can be done. You've got to learn to take the world as it is.
I won't let another man cross my lips.
I know why you say don't eat people, because you're a coward. That's your trouble, a yellow-livered coward. You wouldn't mind eating people if you weren't afraid of anything up the pot yourself. You're going the right way about it, too, son. They'll eat you even if they can't digest your opinions.
I won't eat people. God, I don't eat people.
Regular anthropopathic guy. This crazy idealist notion of yours was to catch on. I just don't know where we'd all be. Just about ruin our entire internal economy. Fortunately, its catching on isn't very likely. Well, you might just as well say, don't fight people.
Don't fight people?
Yeah, don't fight people. Don't fight people. You see what it gets us?
Would you believe it?
Ridiculous!
Michael Flanders and Donald Swan. I suppose it was doubly wrong to eat vegetarians. The moral function of criticism is to educate people by pointing out the deficiencies of the system, whether in politics or art. Many critics take this aspect of the job seriously and sincerely hope that their words will assist the creation of a better system. But the trouble is that a critic has a position of power and will sometimes use it to put across his particular view at the expense of others. And this can lead to repression. A critic of strong views who hates a certain show or book may put off people who'd enjoy it. Perhaps it's better to mark up the show according to the audience who might like it. A report from the Edinburgh Evening News.
Mrs. M. Stevens suggests that the BBC mark items polluted by swearing in the published programmes by an asterisk, or better still, a swastika, and so save people switching their sets on and off.
That sort of idea, which may sound as if it's just offering free choice, is rather dangerous because it makes a moral judgment. It raises the whole issue of censorship. Some critics feel they have an obligation to act as censors, although usually censors come from entirely different walks of life. News from the Sunday Mirror.
The censors appear to have little specialist knowledge of the theatre. Playwright Terence Feely tells me that he asked one of these gentlemen what he did before becoming a censor. And he replied, they were very pleased the way I handled the trooping of the colour arrangement, so they gave me this job.
There's always a fear that criticism may lead to intolerance. An opinion from the old News Chronicle.
Yesterday, somebody who should know about it told me the ancient Greeks were homosexuals. If so, they were a thoroughly bad lot. It's high time we banned Greek from our schools and universities.
We've pretty well done so. It's interesting. That's an extreme example of criticism giving way to prejudice, which is a major danger for every critic. But another constant worry is that the critic is going to lose touch with his audience. In other words, he's going to talk over the heads of the very people he's trying to interest in his subject. critics often seem a bit superior, so they can get hopelessly remote. Stephen Potter.
The critic must always be on top of or better than the person criticised.
The danger of remoteness is even greater in academic circles, amongst university lecturers and dons. More from Stephen Potter.
Donship he defines as the art of criticising without actually listening.
Critics can get so involved in their role as critics that they can't see the wood for the trees. A little verse by E.B. White.
The critic leaves a curtain fall to find, in starting to review it, he scarcely saw the play at all for watching his reaction to it.
The problem's really one of intellectual snobbery. And that's the same, whatever the subject being criticised, even when it's drink.
A lot of people in this country poo-poo Australian table wines. This is a pity, as many fine Australian wines appeal not only to the Australian palate, but also to the connoisseur of Great Britain. Black Stump Bordeaux is rightly praised as a peppermint-flavoured Burgundy, whilst a good Sydney syrup can rank with any of the world's best sugary wines. Chateau Bleu, too, has won many prizes, not least for its taste and its lingering afterburn. Our Smoky 1968 has been compared favourably to a Welsh claret, whilst the Australian Wino Society thoroughly recommend a 1970 Cote du Rod Laver, which, believe me, has a kick on it like a mule. 8 bottles of this and you're really finished. At the opening of the Sydney Bridge Club, they were fishing them out of the main series every half an hour. Of the sparkling wines, the most famous is Perth Pink. This is a bottle with a message in, and the message is, beware. This is not a wine for drinking. This is a wine for laying down and avoiding. Another good fighting wine is Melbourne Old and Yellow, which is particularly heavy and should be used only for hand-to-hand combat. Real Mythic fans will also go for a Chardonnay Bordeaux, and a prize-winning Cuvée Réservé Chateau bottle Nuit Sans Walker, which has a bouquet like an Aborigine's armpit.
Very idle. Obviously, any sort of criticism depends on the ideas and preconceptions of the critic, but he should make some attempt to bridge the gap between his ideals and what the artist presents to him. G.K. Chesterton.
A great deal of contemporary criticism reads to me like a man saying, of course I do not like green cheese. I'm very fond of brown sherry.
It's very difficult to discuss art without sounding precious. Expressing one's emotional reactions is always a problem. And in the world of art, it's more difficult than in any other area to say exactly what you mean in simple words.
The Southern Brave Tractor Drivers, which is being shown as part of the current Festival of Russian Films, Studio 9, Faith Bradshaw.
Well, I'm going to be quite honest about it. I liked it.
You liked it?
Yes. Well, I did. I liked it.
You have to be true about these things.
Yes.
There was a certain rugged earnestness combined with subtlety about it that I found wholly irresistible, but wholly irresistible.
Interesting.
In that outstanding scene alone, where the hero paces the pigsty alone as he wonders what to do, well, the montage in that scene, you know, is so wonderful. It's so fulfilling due to the imaginative cutting of the highest order.
Yes,
it's utterly superb. The camera appeared to flick,
that's
like an inquiring eye from Ivan's tortured face
like
to the cobweb on the ceiling, exactly. Old cobweb to the grandfather's wooden leg standing by itself in the corner. What poignancy there. What a telling touch, you know. This, to me, this is true cinema.
Newton Tweedsdale, what effect did this film have on you?
Well, may I say at once that I found it in the end very tiring.
Oh, really?
Well, I don't pretend to be an ardent film lover, but I did. And I thought that Razumkov, in his direction, was far too eager to project the electric images of his own emotional language instead of allowing the intrinsic concepts of the film to speak for themselves.
Well, I think you're reading that.
Well, no, I do think I am, because have you ever paused in a tube station, for example, and seen a hoarding all torn down?
Yes,
and the girl's face, you know, with old moustaches on it, and what the sense gets in
the... Don't say
all torn down. Well, it's so lonely, so terribly lonely. That's why I prefer Razumkov in his pre-Eisenstein
when
he gave us the biographical trilogy on Lenin. That was when I really liked him.
Well, I'm afraid I was not. Yeah, I can quite see that we've gone arguing this point for a long time. Oh, well, we must now bring the program to a close. Terribly sorry about this mix-up.
That was the critics. All the men were played by Peter Sellers, and the lady was Irene Handel. One of the charges that's constantly levelled at critics by artists is that they don't know anything about the subjects they discuss. Lord Byron again.
A man must serve his time to every trade save censure. Critics all are ready-made. Take hackneyed jokes from Miller, got by rote, with just enough of learning to misquote.
And it's not only in the world of art that this charge is made. Harold Macmillan.
I've never found in a long experience of politics that criticism is ever inhibited by ignorance.
And here's a mark by George Moore.
The lot of critics is to be remembered by what they failed to understand.
As I hinted earlier, the reason for all this rudeness about critics is that most quotable writers have suffered at their hands, and that basically no one likes being criticised. Somerset Maugham.
People ask you for criticism, but they only want praise.
Mark Twain.
I like criticism, but it must be my way.
There's also a feeling among artists that critics are very good at disliking and not so good at praising. An anonymous rhyme.
When I did well, I heard it never. When I did ill, I heard it ever.
There's also a feeling that critics don't stick to their jobs. They will go on about subjects that don't concern them.
Yes, I like the way they did manage, didn't they? Because that tremendous instant feeling, which I for one found tremendously boring. mind you, Ibsen's never been my cup of tea. It's far too strong.
Tell me now, did you find the tea at the National Theatre too strong?
No, I didn't. I found it rather weak. Although weak may be perhaps too strong a word. I did feel that the biscuits had a certain Jacobian
I didn't feel that, too. I'm surprised, though, to hear you mention Ibsen in the context of Yes, We Have No Pajamas. You very much suggested Pinter to me.
Pinter, yes.
I mean, that scene where the man attacks the naked and defenseless girl with a hatchet had all the quality of veiled menace that one associates with Pinter, didn't it?
Yes.
But is this simply Pinter in panties, or is it me?
I think this is the most exciting thing that Brooke has done this week. He directs with a kind of sterile fertility that we know so well. What is the word?
Really?
I did feel, if I may say this, that the introduction of the transvestite scene during the Battle of Trafalgar was a bit squirmy.
If one is going to dress men up as women, I think one really can't do it in a nudist chair. I'd be the last person to be thought of, I hope, as an Earl Prudyfoot.
Do you hope Harold Hobson is the last person to be an Earl Prudyfoot? Milton Shulman.
No, I don't.
I'd like to say a word here about Peter Brook, if I may. If I say that I think he's extremely stupid, I don't mean that in any derogatory sense. I simply mean that he's not very intelligent. If he were more intelligent, he'd be very clever. Nobody isn't, and there we are.
There we are. That's the critic's verdict for this week. Next week, we shall be discussing, for radio, Spoken Like a Man, a sound portrait of Gertrude Stein, a book, My 10 Best Australian Mystics, an anthology edited by Margaret Lockwood, or the exhibition of Objet Trouvé at the London Transport Lost Property Office.
Alan Bennett and Company. The theatre is a world of spiky emotions, and theatrical criticism often reflects this. It sometimes gets very bitchy. In the words of George Bernard Shaw,
a drama critic is a man who leaves no turn unstoned.
A stage performance is such a transient work of art that the business of the critic in this area is especially difficult. John Mason Brown.
To many people, dramatic criticism has seemed like an attempt to tattoo soap bubbles.
Every theatrical performance wants a good press notice, like this one from the Wimbledon Borough News.
The whole cast can be congratulated on making a Shakespeare comedy really amusing.
And here's one from the Sale and Stretford Guardian.
This week, Aldrich and Garrick present Chekhov's The Seagull, a play which does not do justice to a strong cast.
Those are fairly good notices. The ones actors fear are the other sort, and this is what gives them a profound distrust of critics as a breed. P.G. Woodhouse.
Has anybody ever seen a drama critic in the daytime?
Of course not.
They come out after dark, up to no good.
Yes, drama critics are fairly unusual people.
Last week, London theatre goers saw the opening of Neville Shunt's latest West End success. It all happened on the 11:20 from Hainault to Red Hill. Horsham and Reigate, calling at Carshalton Beaches, Malmesbury, Tootingbeck, and Croydon West. In this, as in his earlier nine plays, Shunt attempts to express the human condition in terms of British Rail. A report now from our own theatre critic, Gavin Millar.
Some people have made the mistake of seeing Shunt's work as a load of rubbish about railway timetables, but clever people like me who talk loudly in restaurants see this as a deliberate ambiguity, a plea for understanding in a mechanized ethos. The points are frozen, the beast is dead. What is the difference? What indeed is the point? The point is frozen, the beast is laid out of Paddington. The point is taken. If La Fontaine's elk would spurn Tom Jones, the engine must be our head, the dining car, our esophagus, the guard's van, our left lung, the cattle truck, our shins, the first class compartment, the piece of skin at the nape of the neck, and the level crossing, an electric elk called Simon. The clarity is devastating, but where is the ambiguity? Over there, in a box. Shunt is saying the 8:15 from Gillingham, when in reality he means the 8:13 from Gillingham. The tray is the same, only the time is altered. Eke homo, ergo elk. La Fontaine knew its sister, and knew her bloody well. The point is taken, the beast is molting, the fluff gets up your nose. The illusion is complete. It is reality, the reality is illusion, and the ambiguity is the only truth. But is the truth, as Hitchcock observes, in the box? No, there isn't room. The ambiguity has put on weight. The point is taken, the elk is dead, the beast stops at Swindon, Chabrol stops at nothing. I'm having treatment, and La Fontaine can get knotted.
Eric Idle and John Cleese. The world of literature is another where the critics are very powerful and used to be able to make or break a writer. Here's a little verse by Thomas Hood.
What is the modern poet's fate? To write his thought upon a slate, the critic spits on what is done, gives it a wipe, and all is gone.
The writer cannot know who his reviewer will be and what preconceptions the critic will have. It can be rather worrying. A review from the Spectator.
A reviewer must be honest. The present reviewer is bound to confess that Miss Blank's book offends against such taste as he has and such feelings as live in his mind about the mystery of things. Why should Miss Blank write about ladies picking up their skirts and showing their lovely legs to the men?
Problem, but at least Miss Blank did get her book read, which doesn't always happen. The Reverend Sidney Smith.
I never read a book before reviewing it. It prejudices oneself.
If you're looking, as we are, for a concise condemnation of a book, it's hard to better Dorothy Parker's famous comment. The name she reviewed under was Constant Reader, and she was reviewing A.A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh.
Constant Weaver swelled up.
But as long as there are books, there will be critics to discuss them.
So now the book that we have all been reading is the new novel, The Seeds of Distress by Luigi Salami, published by Bradley Hamilton at 15 shillings. J. Wallace Marwood.
Well, I've been reading Harmonium in the Dust by Eustace Gray.
Oh, I was told to read Tomorrow Is New Yesterday. You know the translation from the Japanese by Lafon.
I was said that nobody has told me to read anything at all. I could think, well, what's the point of talking about it?
Exactly.
Seems to be a bit damn stupid, I must say.
Oh, well.
Rather awkward. Something has obviously gone wrong.
And we'd better pass on to quickly to the film that I do hope you've all been seeing. Peter Sellers and Irene Hands again. We've heard quite a lot of criticisms of critics in this programme, but so far, not the one which is most commonly levelled at them by aggrieved artists. Here it is, succinctly expressed by Benjamin Disraeli.
You know what critics are? The men who failed in literature and art.
Oliver Wendell Holmes.
Nature, when she invented, manufactured, and painted in her authors, contrived to make critics out of the chips that were left.
A lot of this dislike is just the defense of bruised egos. But most artists do resent having their work criticized by someone who is less good at it than they themselves. Mind you, Dr. Johnson gave the answer to this argument when he observed that you don't have to be a master carpenter to be able to complain that the table wobbles. But writers and painters often suffer from the same sort of self-absorption as critics and get very paranoid about criticism from a non-expert. In the words of Channing Pollock,
a critic is a legless man who teaches running.
Perhaps artists would prefer to be criticized by other artists, to exchange intellectual opinions and a healthy atmosphere of literary give and take.
I mentioned before that
I was in Europe. It's not the first time that I was in Europe. I was in Europe many years ago with Ernest Hemingway. Hemingway had just written his first novel, and Gertrude Stein and I read it, and we said that it was a good novel, but not a great one, that it needed some work, but it could be a fine book. We laughed over it, and Hemingway punched me in the mouth. That winter, Picasso lived on the Rue de Bach. They had just painted a picture of a naked dental hygienist in the middle of the Gobi Desert. And Gertrude Stein said it was a good picture, but not a great one. And I said it could be a fine picture. We laughed over it. Hemingway punched me in the mouth. I remember Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald came home from their wild New Year's Eve party. It was April. Written Great Expectations, and Gertrude Stein and I read it. We said it was a good book, but there was no need to have written it because Charles Dickens had already written it. We laughed over it, and Hemingway punched me in the mouth. And that winter, we went to Spain to see Manoletti fight, and he was looked to me 18, and Gertrude Stein said no, he was 19. But that he only looked 18. And I said, sometimes a boy of 18 will look 19, whereas other times a 19-year-old can easily look 18. And that's the way it is with a true Spaniard. And we laughed over that, and Gertrude Stein punched me in the mouth. And then the war came. Hemingway went to Africa to do a book, and Gertrude Stein moved in with Alice Toklas. And I went to New York to see my orthodontist.
Woody Allen. And that's almost the end of this program on criticism. Let's just have a couple more thoughts. One attributed to the composer, Sibelius.
Pay no attention to what the critics say. No statue has ever been put up to a critic.
And a good word of advice from Albert Hubbard.
To avoid criticism, do nothing, say nothing, be nothing.
Very true. But for me and Alfred,
goodbye. I think you could have done that a bit better. It wasn't very good, was it, the way you said
it? Well, I was a bit worried about your reading.
No, you're so good, I think, though.
Frank Muir Goes Into Criticism was produced by Simon Brett and John Davis.